You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although many readers still associate Anne Rice with vampires because of the wildly popular novels she used to write about them, Angel seemed to be at the heart of the fiction she's writing now. Her latest novel, Of Love and Evil, tells the story of Toby O'Dare, former government assassin who travels back in time to Renaissance Italy to perform a good deed at the request of an angel named Malkia. This is Ms. Rice's second novel in a series about Toby O'Dare and Malkia. She's calling Songs of the Seraphim. It's published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased that it brings Anne Rice back to our show today. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm okay. You seem to be almost irresistibly drawn to the supernatural, the spiritual, and the immortal. In addition to writing about vampires and angels, you've written about God and the devil. Do everyday mortals lack appeal for you as subject matter?
Well, I don't know that they lack appeal. It's just that I'm obsessed with God and the devil and questions of good and evil. And maybe I don't feel entirely human and never have. And I'm kind of obsessed with creatures that appear to be human but really aren't, like vampires or witches and angels.
And most of them are immortal as well.
Well, that's true. That's true. I'm always looking through the eyes of someone who feels like she was born in another time. You know, I go into an all-night drugstore and I think, wow, not a thing in here was in existence at the time of Louis XIV. What a spectacular place this is. And I sort of go through the world like that. And I love to create characters who can comment on everything from a perspective like that.
The pharmacy is linked to alchemy going back.
That's true.
Times.
That is very true.
In this novel, Malkia sends Toby back to 16th century Rome to answer the prayers of Vitale de Leoni, a young Jewish doctor. Vitale has become concerned about his own safety because the very ill patient he's trying to cure desperately, a Christian named Niccolo, also happens to be a good friend, is not getting better. Doesn't Vitale understand as a Jew that if Niccolo dies, he's going to be blamed? This is during the Inquisition, isn't it?
Exactly right. And it was very dangerous at that time for a Jewish physician. But Jewish physicians did have the right to be indemnified against being held responsible if their Gentile patients died. They had a right to ask for an indemnification. But Vitale in the novel is in real danger because the house he's living in next door to the patient now has a spirit or a ghost of some kind. So he's being accused of consorting with the devil, basically. And it is the time of the Inquisition, and he's in peril. And when somebody like that is in peril in the Jewish community in those days, the whole community can suffer.
Well, Jews were blamed for the Black Plague earlier.
Sure.
In this case, the real reason that Niccolo is sick is because he's being poisoned by his brother, who's feeding him caviar laced with seeds from a deadly tropical plant.
Right, exactly.
You could get caviar in those days from the, I guess,
I don't know where they got
Iran.
It, but I know they had it, and I know that the Pope used to eat it, and his Jewish physician recommended it. So that's where I got the idea. You know, I found that in one of my books on the history of the Jews in Rome, and I thought, well, that's something I have to use.
Now, you mentioned a ghost. Are we talking about a Dybbuk?
Well, I use the word Dybbuk because they don't really know what it is. They think maybe it's a spirit, maybe some sort of discarnate spirit, but it they don't know whether it's the ghost of a real person or just some sort of demonic entity.
Is this based on a real incident from history?
There is a real incident in it that's mentioned, but the story itself, no, it's just fiction. It's based on everything, on what I made up based on what I read about the community. But there is an incident that's mentioned of a young man in Florence in the days of Savonarola who's accused of blasphemy, and he's killed in a particularly gruesome way. I did find in a history book.
You can still go to the monastery that Savonarola was the head of. It's San Marco in Florence, where Angelica painted some of the most amazing paintings on the wall, the frescoes that are just extraordinary.
I have been
And then you
there.
Go to Savonarola's room after you've looked at all the paintings.
Right. I've been there, and I love that monastery, and I love looking at those paintings because of the way they seem to combine these very touching, naive elements with this great skill and this really ethereal quality. I love Fra Angelico.
Toby is initially surprised that he's been sent to answer the prayers of a Jew rather than a Christian.
Well, he doesn't really question it, but he observes it. And I love doing that, of course, having the angel without any explanation sending him to answer Jewish prayers. And it's the second time. In the first book, Angel Time, Toby was sent to a Jewish community in Norwich, England. And in the Middle Ages, before the Jews were driven out of England. And again, there's no explanation on the angel's part. You know, the idea that there is that God hears the prayers of everyone.
Well, I was wondering if, because you've had a recent, very well-publicized break with the Catholic Church, whether this isn't also a part of your thinking about the role the Catholic Church has played in history sometimes. Because it was so important and powerful, intolerant, a number of crusades, and not only again in the Middle East, but also against Europeans who disagreed.
Well, I certainly was aware of all that when I was writing these books, and I was reading a great deal of church history, and I was reading it with a critical eye, and I was aware. I was becoming aware of how saints that I loved as a child, were actually very anti-Semitic, like St. Louis of France, who expelled the Jews from France after burning I don't know how many copies of the Talmud.
You know? So you were religious when you were young, and then you left the church when you were 18 because you became disillusioned?
I did. I was on a college campus, and I lost my faith. I came to believe that being an atheist was facing reality, and that I had to face reality. And I was also powerfully curious about the whole world. And my Christian Catholic background had been one in which you did not go out and discover the world. You basically stayed within your own Catholic community and you protected your mind from bad influences. I wanted to read all those bad influences like Albert Camus and Jean-Paul Sartre and whatever. I wanted to know what was going on in the world.
And that was pretty much the way you were for 38 years or so?
About that, yeah. I remained an atheist, I think, for about 38 years, and then really went back in 1998 because of deep faith in God, a deep love of God, a deep feeling that, for me, this universe talks of God.
Well, you've written over 30 novels, and the first dozen were about vampires. Did you abandon that as subject matter because of your return to the faith?
I abandoned it because the metaphors no longer work for me. They had been wonderful metaphors when I was an atheist, and I felt I was struggling in the darkness. I really identified with the vampire. It was a great metaphor to use. But
did they represent your loss of faith?
They did. You know, here you have a person who roams the night. He's cast out, but his heart's aching, but he feels like he's cursed. He can't find God. He can't even really find the devil. And I felt that way a lot, and I think those books reflected very much my own search. I didn't move away from them because I came back to God so much as I finished them. I had concluded that phase of my life, and I just wanted to move. I wrote 12, and I really figured that was enough.
Anne Rice's latest book is Of Love and Evil. It is published by Knopf. Well, you've written two of these books, but I gather your next book is not going to be a third in the series. You're going to be writing about ancient Atlantis?
That's what I'd like to do. I want to give Toby O'Dare a rest. I want to come back to him later in a third book. But I really want to write my version of the Atlantis myth or the Atlantis legend or the Atlantis story. You know, take just what Plato told us about ancient Atlantis and give my version of it. And I want to write about a group of immortals who have survived on the planet since that time, and I'm really looking forward to looking at the modern world through their eyes, and it's a great relief that they are not drinking blood and they are not killing people.
Well, so much of the writing involves seeing earlier times through modern eyes.
Right, right. That's true.
Is that something you just realized you were doing, or was that intentional?
Well, I'd like to think that I'm sometimes seeking to look at the modern world through older eyes, you know, or in terms of history. I love
the
to
dialogue
do it all.
Of history.
Sure, to move back and forth. I mean, to me, history is filled with marvelous surprises, and revelations. I mean, you find things all the time that you just didn't know happened. Like, take, for example, the history of the Jews. The Jews really had intimate relations with Christians all through the centuries that they were being persecuted. I mean, they nevertheless had positions of power. They were respected, deeply respected as scholars and physicians. People don't know that story sometimes.
So it was common to find a Jewish doctor working?
At that time in Renaissance Rome, it was indeed. Yeah, there were, and in medieval England, the same thing. They were deeply respected as physicians.
People but the Jews were expelled from England.
They were. They were expelled, and the whole thing had to do with money lending and the king's debts, and it was a very complicated thing.
What do you think of the current vampire craze? Are you surprised by how popular they remain as a subject?
Well, you know,
books, television shows, movies?
I am surprised. I don't know the explanation. At first, I thought, well, it's the richness of the concept. You have this great concept. Of course, people are going to do different things with it. Look what they've done with the cowboy, for example, or the detective, you know, the lone detective. But as it goes on and on, I become more and more puzzled. I don't know what to make of it. When I was writing the Vampire Chronicles, the vampires were not that popular. You know, it was that weird woman with her metaphysical thrillers, you know. But now, I mean, they're virtually everywhere. Maybe it's being driven by Charlaine Harris and Stephanie Meyer. Maybe if you didn't have these two very clever writers, maybe you wouldn't have the vampire craze.
Well, now you have chaste vampires.
Yes,
in the
apparently.
Past, they were very immoral. That was part of the appeal, wasn't it?
Well, in my books, they always struggle. You know, they struggle against their passions. They struggle against wanting to drink blood and wanting to intervene in human life. And I don't know. I mean, I think we're always playing with that concept of what this monster that can kill us, drink our blood, whatever, but he's really maybe lovable and good at heart, you know.
The last time you were here, you had returned to the Catholic Church, and we talked about one of your books that was involved in that. Just after you returned, 2008, not that long ago.
Well, I returned actually in 1998, and then I wrote two books.
Well, there's Christ the Lord.
Christ the Lord out of Egypt and Christ the Lord, The Road to Cana. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a memoir called Out of Darkness about the return to the Catholic Church.
I'm not going to go over all of that again, but
no,
you
not.
Did cause a stir in July when you announced that you were quitting the Catholic Church again.
That's right. Yeah. I felt that
you
I
must
had
have felt like
away.
People were going to give you a hard time on that.
I was prepared for total rejection, but it was something that I felt I had to do. I had been living as a Catholic for 12 years and living as a Christian for 12 years. I had, you know, a huge Protestant audience for my Christian books as well as a Catholic audience. And I still love and respect all those people, but the more I investigated, the more I read scripture, the more I studied, the more I became morally uncomfortable. And I felt finally that I had to declare for my readers, look, I'm no longer a part of Christianity or being a Christian. I believe in God, I believe in Jesus Christ, but I'm walking away from organized religion. I have to for social and political reasons.
Partly because of things like abortion and the gay marriage and things of that sort?
Absolutely. I think the Catholic Church right now in America is persecuting gay Americans and going out of its way to try to block them from obtaining the right to same-sex marriage. And this is from a church that doesn't respect anybody's civil marriage. So why would they do this to this particular minority? I mean, teaching what you believe in your church is one thing, but going out and spending money in California to support Prop 18 to block people from same-sex marriage, I mean, it's legal. You can do this, but I didn't want to be part of it. I didn't want to support it. It made me very upset.
I was interested to learn from watching a video that you posted on your website that Great Expectations by Charles Dickens is your favorite book, and that you learned to become a writer by reading Dickens.
That's really true. That's really true. If I have one teacher, it's Charles Dickens.
Will some grad student who's very, very clever go through your books and find the Dickens connection?
Wouldn't that be great? I would love that. I would welcome that grad student with open arms.
What did you learn from Dickens?
How to present a character intimately, the way he presents Pip in Great Expectations or David Copperfield, and have that character talk to you and reveal to you his own goodness without ever sounding boastful or proud. You know, that the way David Copperfield seduces you and invites you into his world, it's so appealing. It's so wonderful. And yet David's really telling you he's a wonderful guy, brilliant writer, you know, superior to his wife. I thought, what great technique. I mean, and I found my greatest strength in the first-person voice in my novels, trying to open up the world of the vampire through Louis talking in the first person and interview with the vampire. And it was really studying Dickens, studying those early chapters of David Copperfield, the chapters of Great Expectations where Pip opens up his world and his conflict. There's a great ability there on the part of Dickens to tell you almost more than Pip knows, more than David knows, and almost more than Dickens knows.
Have you ever written a book in third person?
I have. I wrote The Witching Hour in third person. I wrote a number of books in third person.
But most of them have been in first person.
They have. I think I do best with the first person.
Although his novels are revered as classics today, Dickens serialized them as he wrote them in order to publish them in a popular magazine of the day. Do you think you have something in common with him in that regard? Are you writing for a popular audience but creating plots and characters and crafting language in a way that might be taken more seriously?
Well, I certainly totally respect him as a popular writer, and I want to be a popular writer. I have never wanted to be just an elitist writer or just a literary writer. I, of course, in my heart of hearts, want to write great fiction, but I very much respect the great popular writers of the past. I think that's the way to do it. If you can you know, make a work of fiction that can be read by an 8-year-old or an 80-year-old and understood by the simplest people and revered by the most educated, that's a great achievement.
You've said that you're a great lover of plot. Do you usually start your novel with a plot in mind?
It grows, but I often do. I often have to have some idea of the whole plot, but it's like a roadmap. But then once I begin writing, there's surprise after surprise, and you have to yield to those surprises.
Flannery O'Connor once said something like, how can you surprise your readers if you're not surprising yourself as a writer?
That's great. Yeah, she was so brilliant. Yeah.
So the plot changes a bit as you write it?
Quite a bit. And I'll have an idea where I'm going for the end, but the end might turn out to be something very different.
What about the names of your characters? You ever change a character's name as you write? Realize that someone is not a Samantha, but a Leona instead?
Oh, yeah. Oh, all the time. I have to have a name to do the character. But if the name isn't working, I'll change it. I mean, Memnock the Devil, Memnock, the character in that book, is supposed to be the devil. And his name was Maximilian, and I just thought, he's just not working. It doesn't feel like a Maximilian. And then I came up with the name Memnock, totally made-up name.
What about Malkia? That is an ancient Jewish name, but it was not anybody of real significance.
No, I looked for that one exhaustively, and I found that name, and I thought, that's it. And I saw him when I got that name.
Anne Rice's latest book is called Of Love and Devil, and it's published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.